welcome to the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Women and Children and People with Disabilities, and Honourable Duncan, yes, and also to the members of the Portfolio Committee on Social Development. Today, Honourable Members, we're having an extraordinary session of the Portfolio Committee. We've decided as a committee and to call upon the Children's Institute to workshop us on the Children's Act and of 2005, Act 38 of 2005. We've all received our files. Is there any member that has not received the files? Everyone's covered? Helen, do you have other ones? I don't know, are you a new member? Now, the Children's Act covers a large area in terms of services to children and also responsibilities and funding requirements, and that are placed with the Departments of Social Development, Justice and Constitutional Development, Education and Health. So today, in terms of the training that we will be receiving, is to deepen our understanding of the Act, Act 38 of 2005, and also how applicable it is to these departments that I've mentioned, what are the challenges, but most importantly, Honourable Members, in terms of our oversight role, what are the status quo in terms of the implementation of the Act. And this session is extremely important, so I would really urge members not to walk out or apologize even beforehand to say they can't stay for the duration of the session, because it's really going to help assist us in terms of our oversight role. Now, in terms of, I just want to take you through, we don't have a specified agenda, and I'm just going to give you just the layout of the workshop today. But before I do that, can I just ask the committee secretary, is there any apologies?
Yes, Jefferson. There is an apology from Honourable Chaba, who is not feeling well, and Honourable Gome, who is also not well, and Honourable Chaita, who is away in Rwanda, and Honourable Masilo, she is going for a checkup. So those are the four apologies I've received. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Committee Secretary. In terms of...
Honourable Kone will join us later. She is just having a meeting with us.
Thank you. In terms of the program, I'm going to ask Paula just to introduce the team from the Children's Institute to us, and after that I'll just take you through the program quickly, and maybe when you introduce your team, could you, Ms. Goudla, could people just wave their hands and say, yeah.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I'm going to actually ask each member to introduce themselves after I've introduced myself. My name is Paula Proudlock. I'm the Program Manager for the Child Rights Program at the Children's Institute, and I'm a lawyer. And I hand over to Catherine.
Good morning. My name is Catherine Hall. I'm a Senior Researcher at the Children's Institute working on child poverty, and I'm a sociologist.
Hi, I'm Lucy Jameson. I'm also at the Children's Institute. I'm the Senior Advocacy Coordinator there. We've been involved in all of the work that went into developing the whole children's bill and then the children's amendment bill to see what you have before you now is the Children's Act. We did a lot of work in coordinating civil society in doing a lot of the participation on the Act. Thanks.
And we also have two interns with us, Ritendo and Tamlin. Want to introduce yourselves?
Mm-hmm. I'm Tamlin Roman, and I'm interning this year.
I'm Ritendo Mrambiwa. I'm also interning at the Children's Institute.
Thank you very much. We're going to have an introduction and overview of today's program. That will be very short, like 5 minutes. Then we're going to go on the presentation on human resource challenges. Then the third item will be a short DVD of about 10 minutes around the Isibindi program, Creative Circles of Care. And then we will have a question and answer session from the Children's Institute. And we will also have a presentation on foster care challenges. I'm sure members will be, it's a concern that members have raised several times in the committee before. And thereafter, we'll have a questions and answer session. And then we will have a presentation on budget challenges. And that will then take us to the end of our session. Okay, so over to you, Ms. Proudlock.
Thank you. Okay, before we start, we need to classify the Children's Act. So we need to look at what type of law are we dealing with. And it's an interesting law because it deals with a Schedule 4 matter, so welfare services, which means that it's a functional area of concurrent national and provincial legislative competence. So this means that both the national and provincial provinces can legislate on this area. So when it was passed in Parliament, the first act was passed as a Section 75 Act under the procedure in Section 75 because it dealt with national competencies. The second bill, which was the Amendment Act, was passed as a 76 procedure bill, so it had to go through the special procedure in the NCOP. Now, it's important to know that this bill needs to be split in two, because when it comes up for amendment, which will be very soon, and the National Assembly and NCOP committee will have to deal with that amendment, it is again going to have to be split. And that splitting can sometimes make it actually difficult to deal with the law in a coherent and comprehensive manner. And you'll see later when we look at the foster care challenges that some of those challenges have actually arisen because the two bills contradict each other in the area around foster care. So just to bear that in mind when you look at how the committees are going to deal with the Third Amendment bill, which will be coming soon. The Children's Act is also what you call a national framework law. So whereas the provinces can legislate in this area of welfare services, the Children's Act will always trump the provincial laws on this matter because it's been enacted in terms of Section 146 of the Constitution, which allows certain national laws to give the national department supervising and coordinating powers over matters that are concurrent between national and province. Oversight with regards to this law is quite complicated because the main responsibility for implementing the Children's Act lies with the 9 provincial MECs. So your provincial legislatures should be exercising oversight of delivery at the provincial level. We should probably look at what is the NCOP's role in that and consider what is the National Assembly's role in holding the provinces to account. The National Department's role is that they're supposed to lead and coordinate the provinces to ensure that the Act is implemented in a coordinated and uniform manner across the country. There are various sections in the Children's Act that outline the national versus the province responsibility. Section 4 is the most important when we look at national, where Section 4 requires the Act to be implemented by organs of state in the national, provincial, and local spheres. in an integrated, coordinated, and uniform manner. And it can't be implemented in a coordinated and uniform manner if national doesn't actually lead the process of its implementation. The provinces have to provide the services. So these are your what you call your provisioning clauses. And the Children's Act says the MEC for social development must provide and fund child protection services, prevention and early intervention programs, child and youth care centers. And then it has a category of services which may be provided and funded. And these are partial care, ECD, and drop-in centers. So you can see very clearly that the responsibility to provide and fund these services rests on the provinces.
Can she please tell us where she is, because we have been looking over documents here. We don't see.
Don't see this. Okay.
The slide is not.
This is just an introduction, so I don't have a copy of this one, but a lot of what I'm presenting here will come through in the early.
It's the short introduction that I referred to. Members can just note that. That's why I read it through. I thought members would just note the introduction. And then in terms of, I don't think members should worry too much with the documentation for now. But here is, you have a summary. Just give me a few minutes. There's a summary on Children's Act Services, which you also find some of the information that Ms. Proudlock was referring to. But just for now, let's just look at the presentation.
Okay, the Children's Act 38 of 2005, that's the name and number of the Act. I think in front of you, you only have the Amendment Act, Act 41 of 2007. Okay, so just to bear that in mind that you're missing half the Act. But important is to know what rights the Act is aimed at giving effect to. And this is in the Objects Clause of the Act. This Act isn't concerned with education or health. For instance, it's only concerned with certain rights for children. So the right to social services is in Section 28(1)(c) of the Constitution. Only children have this right. No one else in the Constitution actually has the right to social services. And that is all the services that fall under the Children's Act are your social services. Then it gives effect to the right to family care, parental care, or alternative care if removed from the family environment. And the most important right that it's constructed around is protection from abuse, neglect, degradation, and exploitation. It's also dealing with the principle of the best interest of the child and the child's right to be heard and taken seriously, which is in the Constitution and in the Children's Act. There are other rights which we can also say it's given effect to, but these are the main ones. And the services that we're talking about when we talk about Children's Act services, the first is partial care facilities. So these are your creches or your after-school facilities. Then you get your ECD centers and your programs, which are often the same as the creches, but sometimes you will get creches that don't actually provide ECD programs. The policy is to encourage and ensure that all creches do, but they are separate chapters. Then you have your prevention and early intervention services, and these include services like parenting programs, home and community-based care, diversion, and child and family counseling. Then you have drop-in centers for vulnerable children. These are not overnight centers, they're day centers where children can drop in for assistance with their laundry, their homework, care after school. It's mainly for vulnerable children. And then you have your protection services, your traditional services that the social workers provide in terms of identifying vulnerable children, assessing them, providing protection, and then also placing children in alternative care. It also includes a support scheme for child-headed households. Then you have your range of alternative care, so foster care, cluster foster care, and adoption, as well as child and youth care centers. Now, child and youth care centers is the umbrella term for children's homes, places of safety, reform schools, schools of industries, and shelters for street children. So these are the services we're talking about today. It's quite, as you can see, a large basket of services. It's not a small act. It's an act of 300 clauses, so it's a substantial area. Now we're going to look at
just to remind about the program, we can't train you on the whole act because, as I said, it's a very big act. So we've chosen three areas that are currently frustrating the system a bit and preventing effective implementation. The first is human resources. So there are a lot of challenges in the lack of sufficient human resources and the ability to develop the various cadres of workers. Then we're going to look at the foster care system, which is, as you will know from newspaper reports and your own discussions, it's in crisis at the moment, and we need to look at why and what are some of the solutions. And then we're going to look at the budget challenges. Okay, I'm going to jump straight into the human resource challenges. There is a PowerPoint in your pack. If you want to find that, then you'll be able to follow. Should be the first one. Okay, this. This presentation is based on research done by the Community Agency for Social Inquiry, the Children's Institute, and the Centre for Actuarial Science at UCT. We look analysing the workforce that is required to implement this act. We're focusing on the workforce that falls under the Department of Social Development. So we're not looking at the magistrates and the police and the justice officials that are also required, because the shortage is mainly in the workers under the Social Development Department. The research is looking mainly at services for children. As you all know, the Department of Social Development has to deliver services to all vulnerable groups, so the elderly, disabled, victims of crime, and children. But you'll see that within the budgets and the implementation plans, children's welfare services is the single largest area of government welfare funding. It's also probably the single largest area of NGO service delivery. So about 50 to 60% of the services for children are delivered by NGOs on behalf of the department with funding from the department. So we're going to look now at who the workers are. So the first category of workers are social workers and auxiliary social workers. In 2011, we have approximately 13,773 registered social workers. This is a statistic from the Council for Social Service Professionals. The numbers of registered social workers has actually gone down. So in 2009, we had 14,322 registered social workers. This doesn't necessarily mean that the number of social workers has gone down, because there are many reasons why social workers don't register. Some have died and been removed. Some haven't paid their fees, and so they are not on the register. Some are still new, and they're still in process of being registered. You'll see later when I look at the bursary scheme that the department reports that their bursary scheme has so far produced 2,000 new graduates. But it's strange that it's not showing up in this number that council has. So there's a mismatch in the numbers, and there's no one database that you can go to find out how we're doing with regards to actual social workers. We also have auxiliary social workers, and you'll see this number has increased since 2009 by 57. So we have 2,057 of these workers. However, most of them seem to be based in Gauteng, so they're not well spread across the country. There is, however, quite a drive to increase this category, and these workers assist social workers with their very heavy caseloads. An important issue to consider when you look at these numbers is that this number of 13,000 or 14,000 includes those working in public services and private. And it also includes those who are providing direct welfare service, so that the foot soldiers, they're out there actually managing cases. But it also includes all those who are managers and administrators and are in office jobs. Okay, and there's been an estimate by a researcher that only 45% of this number are actually in direct welfare services. So only approximately 6,198 are actually on the ground providing services. The Children's Bill costing provides us of an estimate of how many social workers we need, and that's between 16,000 and 66,000 just to provide children's act services alone.
So this doesn't take into account those needed for the Older Persons Act or disabled people or victims of crime. So you can see we have a big problem in terms of numbers here. I was speaking to one of the researchers who compiled the HIV/AIDS scorecard, and they had some numbers from the universities which showed that in 2008, the universities, all the universities, were producing about 1,000 graduates a year. So even if we were to increase that to 2,000, we're still going to take at least 2 years to get up to the numbers just above 16,000, which is the basic minimum required social workers. So it's quite a hard and almost unattainable target that we're chasing. And we have to think about that when we look at the policy options, when we amend the Children's Act. We need to think about shifting tasks away from social workers and using other categories of workers so that we can use the scarce time that we have of social workers for the issues that they really are required for. Then we have another category of worker called child and youth care workers and auxiliaries. There's an estimated 9,000 of these workers in the country. They are mainly in your child and youth care centres. So these are the workers in the children's homes, the places of safety and secure care centres. About 8,000 are in those homes. The other 1,000 are out in the community providing services to orphans and vulnerable children. And those are the workers that you're going to see in the DVD who are rolling out the Isibindi model. These workers are employed both by NPOs and government, about 3/4 by NPOs and about 1/4 by government. We don't know how many we need because this category wasn't costed in the children's book costing. The good news with regards to this category is that the Minister of Social Development has announced an intention to roll out this category of workers, Isibindi model. This will employ and train 10,000 child and youth care workers who will mainly be women and youth who actually come from the communities where the services are needed, and that's going to be in rural areas. And it's going to provide prevention and protection services to approximately 1.8 million orphans and other vulnerable children. And it will also capacitate and supervise 400 NGOs or CBOs and also district DSC officers to implement the CCBND model. So I'll talk quite often today about what's called a social franchise model. These are the models that are run by quite big NGOs, and they've got offices throughout the country, and they manage to have projects in many provinces, and most of them are funded substantially by the department and are performing these functions on behalf of the department. And the rollout of Isibindi is good news for everyone because it's actually going to use a number of those large social franchises, not just NACCW, but it'll also use Child Welfare, NOAA, Nelson Mandela Children's Funds, Orphans and Vulnerable Children Projects, as well as World Visions. So it's a big collaboration between government, USAID, and a number of NGOs. This is currently Isibindi has 67 rural and urban sites in all the provinces. You can see there on the slide the numbers, and you'll see they are in every province. Some provinces have less than others. And currently they employ 1,071 child and youth care workers and reach 64,000 children annually. So if you see that target of reaching 1.8 million, this scale-up is actually a very large project that the minister is undertaking, and it's going to require a lot of support from everyone involved. The other good news about this rollout is that it's going to be using money from the President's Job Fund. So as you'll see in the budget presentation later, there's not a lot of money at a provincial level for implementing the Children's Act, and we need to start looking creatively to other pots of money. And this proposal by the minister is going to tap into the job fund and create jobs in the social sector. Then there are other workers that we also need to look at, probation officers who are social workers who've specialized in probation, and these are important for the children who are in trouble with the law and need to be assessed and sent for diversion. So they also, in fact, these workers are also needed for the Child Justice Bill. We don't know how many workers we have, and the majority are employed by government. Then we have ECD practitioners. We don't have a current statistic on them, but we know that in 2000 we had 54,000 ECD practitioners. There has been a lot of expansion since then because a lot of government priority funding has gone to ECD. Almost 99% of these workers are employed by NGOs, and then those centres are subsidised by the state with ECD subsidies. Then we have community care workers, who a lot of these actually fall under the Department of Health, so your home-based carers and your community health workers, approximately 65,000 of these. Most are affiliated to NPOs and they're paid stipends, and many are volunteers. Then you have a lot of managers and administrators, both in the provincial offices as well as in the NGOs, who manage these services and administer them. Then we need to look at who's funding the services. Government funds these services in five different ways. Employing its own staff, so these are your government personnel in the provincial departments. Through transfer of money to NPOs, these are called NPO transfers in the budget. Through payments to commercial enterprises, these are for-profit companies that are providing certain welfare services. Then also through allocations to government funding agencies. Most important for this committee is the National Development Agency. So the National Department transfers some of its budget to NDA. NDA then transfers that money to NGOs providing services. And also there's money through the Expanded Public Works Program, particularly stipends for home and community-based carers. The delivery indicators are showing that the NPOs deliver services to more government, more people than government is, as well as commercial. So your NGOs are your main service delivery workforce. But the NGOs are struggling with sufficient funding because they're only partially funded by government and they have to make up the rest from donors. And due to the recession, the donor pool has shrunk, and so many NGOs are struggling. The other source of funding that's coming in is, as I said, the donors, and most of it is foreign money, so it's not local money. So the big money comes from the bilateral donors, the other governments, USAID, CEDA, Irish Aid, DFID. You know, it's not coming from our own corporates. You'll find that the corporate funders in South Africa tend to prefer to fund education, sports, and recreation. Childcare and protection is not that favoured. When we look at government services, you'll see that these services probably have a higher ratio of social workers to other social welfare workers. So the social workers are predominantly sitting in government. And you'll see this has increased over a number of years because government salaries are higher than the NGO can pay. So many of the NGO social workers have moved into government. And all your new graduates go straight into government because they have bursaries from the departments. These salaries are fully covered by government, including good benefits. The workers are unionized, therefore they're able to collectively bargain for improvements in their salaries and conditions of service. And in recent years they've benefited from the OSD, Occupation Specific Dispensation, so there's higher pay and there's better provision for career progression within the civil service. So a lot of the concerns of government employees in the sector have been addressed and there's great improvement there. However, the services that government delivers are much more expensive than the services that NGOs deliver, and you'll see that coming through in one of the court cases that we're going to refer to. And it's mainly due to the high cost of the salaries of the government workers. Then you get commercial services. It's not a common way of funding for welfare services. It's more common for private prisons that fall under the Department of Correctional Services. But you do get some commercial funding or commercial organizations delivering services in the children's sector, particularly in alternative care and secure care centers. And these are the same companies that are also running the private prisons. When these companies run the services for government, government pays the full cost of the service plus profit to these private companies. So these services are also expensive, similar to the government cost of providing them, sometimes more. There are three main ways that government funds the NGOs. The first is by a subsidization of social worker and related posts. Here, government only covers part of the salary of the social worker and at entry level. Okay, so that's way below the government OSD level, and it also excludes benefits. An example here is all the child protection services that are performed by your child welfare officers around the country. Those social workers posts are only partially funded by government. Then the second way is through program funding, and this also only partially covers the cost of the program. It's often used to fund pilots or new initiatives, new innovations. There is talk of moving all funding to program funding in recognition that when you run a project, you have staff, you have activities, you have goods and services, and that you need a mixed model of funding, not just a per capita or a post funding. The third way that government funds is a per child subsidy. This is common for child and youth care centres, so it's an amount per child per month, and government is paying between 1,700 and 2,500 per child per month for homes run by NGOs. And when it comes to ECD funding, it's between 12 rand per child per day and 15 rand per child per day. Now, the variation is because each province has different levels, which is a bit of a problem, seeing that what we're dealing with here is a national framework law which is required to ensure uniform service delivery. So depending on whether you're a child in the Eastern Cape or in Western Cape, you're going to get a different level of service delivery due to this different level of subsidization. Here's an example from the Eastern Cape. Here, when the Eastern Cape funds children's homes run by NGOs, they fund at 1,700 per child per month, plus they also give a subsidy for social worker posts. And they fund one post for every 50 children, but they only pay 75% of the actual cost of that post. Then for street shelters, they pay a lesser subsidy per child per month of 1,520. And then they don't pay for any additional funding for social worker posts, which is a problem because the norms and standards of the Children's Act require shelters to have social worker posts. So you can see this. What's clearly out of sync is the funding model versus the requirements of the Children's Act. So the funding model, which is currently being revised by national and by the provinces, is something that needs to be engaged with to ensure it's harmonized with the Children's Act. The general concerns about the NPO funding is that the funding is generally granted annually, both by government and by donors, and this allows for the NGOs to plan long-term or to ensure job security for their workers. Some provinces have moved to three-year funding cycles, and they're signing three-year agreements with the NGOs, but the agreements cannot specify the second and third-year amounts, and also can't guarantee inflation-related increases, mainly due to the way the MTEF is voted on an annual basis. The main complaint around government funding is the payments are quite erratic and late, and that funding is only partial. Now, this problem of partial funding has resulted in a court case, and this is the Nawango court case. It's in your pack. There's a four-page summary of the case. The second judgment was just delivered last week. And in this case, the NGOs are calling for equal subsidy of children's homes that are run by NGOs and those that are run by government. So the evidence shows that for those run by government, the department was paying 6,000 per child per month, whereas those run by the NGOs, they were paying 2,000 per child per month. So it's the same children. The children's court is dealing with these children and says this child is in need of care, protection is a ward of the state, it must be placed in a children's home. So luck of the draw, whether that child ends up in a government children's home or an NGO children's home. But they're likely to get a better quality of service than the government one due to the fact that the government one is better subsidized. And the Free State High Court has said that this policy is unfair, unreasonable, inequitable, and ordered the Free State Department to amend its policy and come back with a revised policy. The Free State came back with its revised policy, and the court engaged with it and sent it back again, saying it's still not fair. And the main problem that the court has stuck on is that the money that's given to the province is insufficient, and that's the province's problem. So the province is saying we can't actually give more to the NGOs because we're not getting enough from our provincial treasury. And provincial treasury is saying we're not getting enough from national. So I'm going to talk a bit more about that in the budget presentation, because there are there are some systemic flaws in the way the budget decisions are made, and that's ending up that provinces aren't actually getting sufficient money to implement this. But then provinces are also sometimes making trade-offs that might not be in the interest of greater service delivery. So they are cutting NGOs and putting the money into government salaries, which doesn't necessarily translate into more services for children, because you can employ less government workers on the amount of money that you can employ NGOs. So there's some strategies that provinces are adopting to deal with their budget shortfalls that are not necessarily going to help with services. The other problem that the NGOs are facing is that they're having high staff turnover because the workers are moving into government. The workers aren't unionized because they're employed by thousands of different NGOs, so they're not unionized, so they can't collectively bargain for improvements. We do, however, have umbrella organizations representing them. And so in 2009, we had an Equal Pay for Equal Work campaign that was run by the Welfare Forum and NACOS. And that did actually result in significant changes, particularly in Gauteng province, improvements for the NGO transfers. And then we have the Nawanga court case, which is the fact that the NGOs have ended up in court is indicative of the fact that they feel they're not being heard. And we had a presentation last week in National Treasury at a conference that we co-organized with National Treasury, where the National Department presented its new funding policy for NPOs. And it presented it as finished. And the outcry from the NGOs was, but you haven't consulted us. It hasn't been published for comment. So that's also something maybe this committee can play a role in, is that before that policy is actually finalized, it should at least be coming to Parliament, for Parliament to engage with the policy. It has huge implications for all the vulnerable groups and the implementation of the Older Persons Act and the Children's Act in particular. If the NGOs are successful in this court case, it could double the budget at a provincial level. So it has also huge monetary implications. Government has its own funding agencies as well, so NDA and the lottery. These are also coming up as major funding sources for Children's Act services. We've recently done research together with CASE on donors to look at how much are donors actually providing to Children's Act services. And we found that they're providing approximately 1 billion, that was in 2010-11, and this compares to government's 3.4 billion. If you compare that, you can see that the donors are actually contributing a quarter of the total funding for Children's Act services, which is quite a substantial portion. And the largest donors are the ODAs, the foreign governments, who are donating approximately 800 million. And the donations are to national government, provincial government, and NGOs. So donors are playing a big role. This is what I mentioned earlier about the social workers, bullet number 5 in this slide. The department at a national level is allocating quite significant amounts of money to fund the bursary scheme, and it is having good results. So they're at the moment funding 4,400 social work students with bursaries, and they've got 100 new scholarships coming on. So that's a significant number of social workers. However, they're only coming out at 1,000 every year. A problem with the bursary scheme is that it's only for social workers. It's not providing for the other categories to also have bursaries. However, some of the provinces also have their own bursary schemes, separate to the national one, and they are funding social auxiliary workers and child and youth care workers and home and community-based carers as well. So the last slide on this area is just a list for you of some of the policy processes that need oversight. These are the processes that are going to be addressing or dealing with many of these challenges that I've mentioned. So the first is the draft social service professions policy, which is going to lead to the draft social service professions bill, which is the bill that regulates council and the professional boards for social workers, child and youth workers, and probation officers. I think that's only on your program for coming to Parliament in 2013, 2014, but the policy might come earlier. There's also regulations under the Social Service Professions Act that are desperately needed and have been bottlenecked for about 3 years, And these are the regulations that will allow child and youth care workers to register with the council. If they can register, they can be regulated and they can be counted and they can be professionalised. They're desperate to register, but there are certain blockages at the council level. The department is also developing a human resource model. It's also not yet finalised, and that's broader than the Children's Act. It's for all the human resources for social development. They've also commissioned research on situational analysis on social welfare workers. And then finally, this national policy on the financing of NPOs and the 9 provincial policies. The Free State is the one whose policy is in court, but all the provincial policies are actually based on the national. So here's an example where national really has to lead, finalize their policy, so the provinces can all amend these to ensure that they're in line with the Constitution, the Children's Act, and the Older Persons Act. Okay, before we go for questions, we're going to do a DVD. What we're showing you here is the Isibindi model that the minister is going to be rolling out to reach 1.8 vulnerable children. Some of the references in the video refer to the Child Care Act, and some of the numbers are wrong because this is the video is 3 years old. But we're showing it so you can get an idea of what this model is about and where it's going to be, and what children is going to serve.
Government said, okay, and she said, I can have that money for her because nothing's, everything's okay. You can see I'm not talking now. Everything I'm telling the government is right. And so I'm keeping worried, keep on worrying about that. Because I want to do something while I'm still alive. When I die sometime, anytime, there's a baby for someone to look after. I'm just what I'm thinking about now because I'm in the field. I'm not right now. I'm trying to get, choose the one I know is a good person. Rather than say, have a check, look after the baby, all the money goes to her, and she must look after my baby.
Kukumar, 10 years old, is a child with many responsibilities. Child and youth care worker Lungi helps her and her family to cope. Gugu's mother is sick. Her father has died and is buried in front of their ancestral home. Gugu is the eldest of 7 children. In Umbungulu, KwaZulu-Natal, the community has initiated a unique response to the growing number of orphans. It is called Isibindi, creating circles of care. The Isibindi model was conceived by the National Association of Child Care Workers. Isibindi is a Zulu word meaning courage.
The life space is basically the place where children are, where children live out their lives. The child and youth care workers are people who move into the child's life where the child is living their life. And they move alongside of children and youth in order to be with them in their everyday life space and use what it is that they're doing on a daily basis to assist them to make the next developmental steps in their life.
Lungi has a family of her own at home, but she's at the Kumalos most days, the glue holding the family together. Her goal is the survival and development of the children. She provides emotional support and assists the Kumalos in just about every aspect of their lives. Gugu bears a huge burden. But if you are at home, she has the freedom to play.
Many people argue, for instance, around the term vulnerable children. They say many of these children are very, very resilient children. We shouldn't be labeling them as vulnerable. But essentially, the child and youth care worker's job is to try to create a situation in which young people are assisted to cope with the demands that exist around them, but at the same time have the opportunity to experience some of the necessary activities of childhood, like playing, for instance.
This, then, is the essence of the Isibindi strategy, to use daily events in the life of children developmentally and therapeutically to hold families together, to sustain and nurture them, to provide hope where the orphan is none, to create circles of care. Shane Leeway, another trained child and youth care worker, lives down the road from Lungi. She takes responsibility for the development and nurturing of schoolboys at Peaceful Tool and his brothers after the death of their parents and sister. The three teenagers are coping relatively well. Shane would provide an adult touch, a woman's touch, structure, emotional support, hope.
Vulnerable children in our country. Obviously, any answer to the difficulty that children face in our country is multifaceted and multi-pronged. What we're saying is that this appears to be a cost-effective model for dealing with vulnerable children and families.
Although he is young, Sipiso has become the head of his household, but a home needs an income, and he's still at school. Lungi has arrived early. She must work quickly today so that she can help Gugu with the history project when the child gets back from school. Mrs. Kumalo is in bed.
I think the history of our country has left people with a sense and commitment to contribute to nation building, to contribute to building society. And many of the child and youth care workers who've trained in community indicate that they wouldn't want to work anywhere else but in their community making a contribution.
Child and youth care workers must be multi-skilled. Theirs is a balancing act between their child and children as children, while at the same time speeding up their preparation for adulthood. They often meet with supervisors and other professionals to plan their interventions. Aid threatens the fabric of South African society. It is estimated that 1.5 million children will be orphaned by 2008.
We can't help the children if the child is worried about that tema like sick. You can't go anywhere with that child. You have to solve the problem that the mother is sick, what I'm doing with mother, so that the child can go to school. Because the child can't go to school leaving her mother sick in the bed with no one to take care of her.
In many South African neighborhoods, children stay home to nurse sick parents. In time to come, these children will have neither parents nor education. This scenario, the ECB in the project seeks to avoid. On the shoulders of children such as these rests the burden of the future of the nation. Mrs. Kumalo would like Lungi to become the foster parent of her children, but this is not the only family Lungi will visit today.
The child and youth care workers would be trying to build on the family strength as well as the individual children's and youth's strength in order to help them to be able to cope autonomously ultimately. That might mean bringing in other adults into their lives in order to assist to create a context in which they are protected and cared for.
If you do something with love, you can do it.
The women have grown very close, but there comes a time each day for Lungi to leave. A long-term solution to the family's plight may lie with a kind aunt of Gugu's, who is being encouraged to move in as a foster parent with the family in Umbumbuz. Lungi will stay with the family to ensure the transition is smooth. The big day has dawned for Sipiso. He must persuade the magistrate he is capable of becoming the foster parent of his younger brother.
With the pandemic of the HIV and AIDS-related household, and given the background history I was enlightened on about this project, I decided that children will have to become our primary concern for the future.
Tell me, Sipiso, are you presently taking care of your siblings, Sandile and Itanda?
I have provided them in terms of section 15(1)(b) of Act 74 of 1983. It is ordered that the children...
The magistrate is satisfied that with the help of a child and youth care worker, the people can administer foster grants on his brother's behalf.
Under the supervision of the social worker.
The child care workers are basically the parent role in his household. they play that role of mother and father. They assist him with the groceries, the basic necessities of schooling, their clothes, and all the other basic necessities needed for the day-to-day life.
The
foster funds have arrived, and the family needs to determine how the money is to be spent. With guidance from Shengyi and the Isilin Initiative, the Bezos family is recovering from the trauma of the loss of their parents. With the assistance of the court, they are asserting their independence. In the context of the suffering caused by AIDS, a family trip to buy groceries is a try. The family unit is a return. Shen Yiwe has recognized that a family celebration is appropriate. She and the diesel have set money aside to last until next month. Candles are lit tonight. It's a moment of joy. Life changes.
I'm sorry.
Lungi rises earlier than usual on Mondays to get Mrs. Kumalu medicine at the clinic before the queue. Ugu cannot fetch the medicine because the clinic is not allowed to dispense it to one so young. Mrs. Kumalo herself is too weak to make the trip. She's being treated for tuberculosis, an opportunistic disease commonly associated with AIDS. Umbumulo has risen to a new day. There is little time this morning to help prepare the children for school, to ensure they are clean, strong, and fed. Association of Child Care Workers has assessed their living conditions and determined that the children need a comfortable and secure family home. Money has been raised, traditional authorities consulted, and plans set in motion to demolish the old mud structure. An architect comes to Umbumbul to discuss their new house with the children. The new home will establish the family's roots. No relative, no neighbor can take it away. Under Lungi's guidance, and with the help of a child minder whose salary is paid out of the children's foster grants, things have begun to settle in the formerly troubled Kumalo home. Rain no longer pours through the roof. There is a sofa to sit on, new beds and a fridge. The children are healthy. They are together. South Africa has a chronic AIDS problem. But where there is courage, there is hope. From magistrates to child and youth care workers, from grandparents to community leaders, all South Africans are being called upon to be greater than themselves.
Thank you very much. I think it was educating but also very moving DVD. Honourable members, it's now time for questions. We're running into severe time constraints. Any questions on the presentation? On the presentation analysis of human resource capacity and complaints, and then also on the ECBINI program, if you have any. Honourable Member Ramudive, Chairperson.
I have only one, maybe one or two. It was not clear to me. I couldn't see the. And thank you for the presentation. I was not able to see clearly the slides that showed the numbers where I saw Free State having one. I couldn't make it because I wanted to ask. Yes, I can. It's not very clear. One can't see on, you know. But maybe if you can explain why is it reflecting one under Free State, and then the ECBINI program. Is it a national program? And yeah, lastly, is it? I think the program is quite good, but I'm not sure to what extent. You know, is it in existence in other provinces? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Any Honourable Member Lamula and Honourable Member Kenya?
Just on the ECBINI program, is there any special criteria for this program? Especially when one looks at the number of ECBINI projects in different provinces. And then, it was a very interesting story. Extremely interesting, but how many ECBINI models are up and running, especially in some rural areas, and I'm thinking of Limpopo. I see there are only three of those projects in Limpopo. How many success stories do we have? Is this the only one? Are there other provinces?
Are you talking about child-headed household?
Child-headed household, especially with
bearing
in mind that we have 1.8 orphans. And yeah, that's my question. Criteria for the ECBINI model to be implemented in provinces. And then on, I'm referring to Limpopo because we have tremendous problems in Limpopo, especially with NGOs. NGOs not being, not receiving their funding in time. Some of them still without funding for last financial year. That is why I'm referring to that one. And then I'm surprised to hear that we have no database on how many social workers we have. Just elaborate on that. Thank you.
Now, I think, let me just, the last question is, what they're saying from the Children's Institute is what they gauge from the social workers professional right. So they have the database of registered social workers. So what members should also I was actually tempted to intervene there, because when social workers also become managers, so they will become managers of social work programs, and it's almost like graduating out of active social, generic social work into management. So you will find them running the probation services program and so on. So we also lose them, and they also make very good HR managers, by the way. So they leave the profession and they start specializing in different areas. And that is also one of the reasons that your social workers basically disappear. They don't renew their registration. Can we get more questions? Honourable Lamula, you finished? One more? And then Honourable Member Kenya.
On the turnover of social workers and the amount needed. And this was brought to the attention of the department in 2005 already, that to implement the Children's Act we need 66,000. And the shortage of social workers is a great concern. It's just a community.
Thanks, Honourable Member Lamula, Honourable Member Kenya, and then Nasa Chua.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I've got only three questions. On the issue of human resources, as you say that the government, they are moving from, workers are moving from the private sector to the government sector because of high salaries. But have you got any attention strategy before to cap the problem? Why? Two, on the issue of social workers also, is there any research on gender statistics? If we say that you want to check gender statistics, what am I looking at? I'm looking at the for recruitment purposes, looking at gender imbalances in the workplaces. Have you got any gender statistics? How many females are maybe, how many males in the social working field, so that we can also the gender imbalances. And lastly, on the issue of the, you're talking about the model of funding, which is not the same, is not uniform. And you made an example about the Free State. Have you also made a survey or researched how many provinces have got this problem, so that when we say we want to check this uniform of model of funding, of model funding, so that all of them are on par. Have you also made your assessment in other provinces? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member Kenny, Honourable Member Kopane, and then Honourable Member.
Thank you, Shen. Thanks for the presentation. Sorry to be late, I was thinking somewhere. I really, when I was looking at the DVD, I was really touched and moved at what is happening, because that is happening every day with our people in the community. But the other thing I asked myself when I was looking at that woman who was sick in the bed, she couldn't look after her own children. But when I was looking at the number of children that are there, that was a question. Then I was saying to myself, maybe we as lawmakers, when we deal with things, we like treating the symptoms rather than the cause of the problem. Because I believe maybe we still have a lot of to do about our education campaign in terms of our people to plan their family, in terms of the resources, your capability as a person. And the other thing that I'm looking now is, if you check the numbers of the social grants beneficiaries, about 10 million, out of 14 million of the people who are receiving the social grants, 10 million of them is a child support grant. And it's also putting a huge, you know, impact on the taxpayers' money. That is another thing. So we need to do a campaign to educate people in terms of family planning. And secondly, though I believe according to our constitution, it's for every, the government has to look after those people who cannot look after themselves. But we also have to teach our people their responsibility, because as a parent, you have to learn to look after your own kids. If you bring a child on this world, you have to, especially the father, because most of the children who are there who are receiving the grants, the father, they just decided to disappear somewhere, knowing that the government will look after us. Maybe those are the other things that we have to look into. And my question is regarding the Isibindi. Somehow, I just wanted to find out, Sibindi, does it have some sort of a coordination system where it works with other community home-based carers into the community? Because my worry now, social development, we are having our own, so
community home-based carers, and the Department of Health, they're also having community home-based carers. So is there any system that is in place in terms of, you know, supporting each other, sharing the expertise and knowledge, even sharing the resources? Because sometimes you find that community home-based carers, there's a duplication of service. The Department of Health will be seeing this patient, do whatever, and leave. After 20 minutes, come another community home-based carer. So that is my question. Thank you, Chef.
There was this one chap, old man, that he gets washed twice a week, or twice a day, by two community home-based care workers. He wasn't complaining about being washed so much, but he just said he thinks there's a duplication. So, and social services, home-based care workers, social development home-based care workers are there to look at, to give psychosocial support to families. And while your health is there in terms of to see that the patient gets drinks and tablets, they are washed and they are cared and looked after. But sometimes what the home-based care workers do, they blur the roles. So they end up doing the same thing instead of each one just keeping to what they're supposed to do in the two departments. But the Department of Health does the training of, is responsible for the training of community home-based care workers. They have the responsibility for the training. So sometimes, yes, I do agree. People seem tend to blur, and that is where your in terms of your quality assurance processes, your monitoring and evaluation comes in, to see that NGOs do the work that they're supposed to do, they get paid for, and not really transgressing on what the other NGOs have to do, or CBOs in this case. Yes, Honourable Member Kopat.
Thank you, Chair. Just a follow-up on what we have just said. The other issue that is facing us is a challenge. Though we're having this community youth care workers, home-based care, people who are doing the job on the ground. But the other key thing is that since we're having a shortage of social workers, we still have people who don't supervise them to do the quality job on the ground. So maybe we also have to address the issue of quality job more than the quantity job. That is the other key challenging issue. Thank you.
Honourable Member Makuba. Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I have a request to Paula that maybe I would like to have a copy of the slide and the last one that you spoke about, the policy process needing oversight that you spoke about. Maybe if it could be forwarded to our secretary and she can make copies for us. And I'm not going to talk a lot now about the social workers because it is very clear that we have a crisis. If we have 13,773 registered social workers now, when we're actually needing to have between 16 and 66,000, that really shows that there's a serious problem. And here we're just talking of one part of social work, not for the whole social responsibilities. I just want to know, it's actually a matter of clarity, that on non-profit organizations, where you spoke about the main approaches used by government to fund NPOs, when say on the first one, where the government covers only part of the salary of these people, because they are playing a very good role, very important role. I'm just concerned, I just wanted to find out where would they usually find the other part, you know, to cover the balance of what is left that is not funded by the government. And what is it that maybe your organization think we could do as members of this parliament to assist you with this problem? And the last one, I just want to know, non-profit organization 3, where you spoke about the Nawongo court case. What was the explanation that was given by the Free State DSD that NPO's
running children's homes should have 2,000 rand only allocated for per child per month, whilst the government run homes were allocated 6,000 per child per month. Thank you.
Any
responses? Thank you, Chairperson, and also thank you very much for the invitation. It is always good to be around the Children's Institute because they come with telling us about stats and where we actually stand with children, so it's much appreciated. I have a couple of concerns, and then maybe to start off by asking the Children's Institute. You do bring all of this under our, you know, you do the research and you're telling us actually this is the situation. If you have any recommendations as to how government can get there, then I think maybe it would be greatly appreciated. Because very often we do get all of this, and we know what is happening in government, and we know that government is currently not sufficiently and effectively addressing the rights of children in almost all aspects. But we're talking about the Children's Act now. So I just thought, let me just say that. Then, Chairperson, starting off, this will always remain a problem, and I'm not negative. I'm very positive because I know that the NGOs is the strengthening and the lengthening of service delivery to the people working together with government. However, I think we need to find some way of really monitoring and evaluating the NGOs because I know that National Parliament has adopted an outcome-based approach, which means that we need to see a difference in the lives of children. We really need to see it. We need to visibly see it, and not. So that is a concern, and because we're saying the Children's Institute is telling us 60% of delivery comes from NGOs, which means that 40% is done by government. So I think maybe we need to find some way of really monitoring and evaluating what is going wrong at our NGOs. And if I think of social workers, I mean, you are demotivated if you know that you're working for an NGO, that your salary is almost half of what people get in government. It's something that we need to change. We just simply have to change it. So that is maybe if we could get from the Institute couple of ideas as how to address it. And then lastly, the program that video that we've seen is again what I always see. Yes, social development do have the largest role when it comes for our children when it comes to welfare. However, we have seen what happened. Finally, they had a new home built for them, which means it's not only social development responsibility. It is a transversal issue. Economic development has to come on board. Everybody has to come on board. The whole of government has to respond to the needs of children, because it's not just a matter of keeping them healthy, giving them food, putting structures there and all of it. It is actually give them economic empowerment. And they can only get that if all departments come on board, and I'm sure that we will be able to reach it then. So, that is just not necessarily a lot of questions, but rather input. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Can I ask that some of the questions in terms of budgeting and so on, can we leave it for when we come to the presentation? Then Ms. Proudlock can respond to that. But that we deal with the issues pertaining to the presentation that we had. Yes, I think it will be very good for us to get copies of the DVD. I want to agree with Honourable Member Makuba around the ECBD program. Over to you, Ms. Proudlock. And after that, we'll break for 5 minutes. I'd actually like to suggest that the committee does a site visit to the ECBND model. I see on the committee program that you're going to the Eastern Cape at the end of June. to actually visit child youth care centres and child-headed households. And you could maybe, as you'll see in the Eastern Cape, there are 11 SABND sites, and we could liaise with NACCW so you can go and visit and actually see it in action and see what they're doing there on the ground and meet some of the child and youth care workers. The question about how are these sites chosen, the development of them is based on a number of factors. The first is that NACCW, which is the mother organization, it's the National Association of Child and Youth Care Workers, it's almost like a union for all these workers, but it's more a training organization, so it manages their training and ensures that they're regulated because they can't be regulated by council, so that's what this organization is, that they're performing that function. So the first thing they looked at was, you know, where are the majority of poor children, and you'll look from those stats, KwaZulu-Natal has the majority of poor children in the country, followed by Eastern Cape, Limpopo, Gauteng. So they're doing quite well in KwaZulu-Natal and Eastern Cape, but they're not doing well in Limpopo or also in the Free State. Another issue that needs to be looked at is HIV prevalence. And again, the Free State features there is about number three in terms of HIV prevalence. So the Free State needs to be targeted when they expand this project. So, but also what's been, why it might look like they're not everywhere they should be is because it's funding dependent. So it also depends on whether NACCW can form a relationship with the provincial department. So they have a very good relationship in the Northern Cape, for instance, and there's great expansion happening there, but they don't have such a good relationship, say, in the Western Cape or the Free State. But the change that will happen now, because this program has been endorsed by the minister, is that there's going to be a careful selection of where the site should be based on poverty, HIV prevalence, linking up to other government priority programs in rural areas. And so the rollout is going to be well thought through. And I know for definite that Limpopo is one of the primary targets for the rollout. I'm not sure about Free State, I'll have to look for that. But you can maybe, if you do the site tours, actually to ask NACCW while you're on the tour to give you a thorough presentation on the rollout plan. Because what you'll also see from the plan is that there's teams of 13 child and youth care workers, and there's two team leaders, and there's one senior child and youth care worker who normally has a FET diploma in child and youth care work and has a number of years of experience. So that leader has to supervise the team. Some members of the team are brand new. They train for about 3 years while they're on the job, and then they get their FET certificate at the end of the 2-3 years. And then they can go beyond that to get a degree, but at the moment most of them are stopping at the FET. But there is the beauty with the social franchise models like the ones run by NACCW or those run by Child Welfare is that they've mostly been funded by USAID, who has very, very strict financial requirements and very strict monitoring and evaluation. So these models have very good M&E systems, and they can therefore produce good statistics on, they can even show you how many of the children have stayed in school as a result of these interventions, because they have to collect those statistics. So that's the advantage of using the social franchise model. At the conference I was recently at with donors, treasury and the department, there was talk about the need for government and donors to streamline their M&E system so that the NGOs don't have to do two, you know, because at the moment they're having to do a lot for the different donors and then also for the department. And there's a need to bring them together so that you've got one M&E system. And this may be something you can ask the national department and the provinces to talk about, you know, what are their M&E systems and how are they streamlining them. Then with the social worker crisis, a recommendation would be to ask the national department to come in and present its plans for addressing this problem, and also to call the council in at the same time, because council and the department have to work together on this. And to actually interrogate the plan, because as I said before, they're chasing a moving target, and the plan is not big enough. And they need to rethink the plan, go back to the design board. And one issue to look at is how do we actually produce more social workers. We have to look at how to retain them, because they are an immigrating category, because the developed world wants our social workers. So it's hard to keep them. So we also have to look at other workers in South Africa, the indigenous workers,
come from the communities where they are living and stay there, because those are your workers who are not going to immigrate, and they're also cheaper. So to do two things, you know, make sure we get more social workers, but also task shift and recognize the other workers who can take up the slack and work together with the social worker. And about the question of how, is there a strategy to curb NGO workers from moving into the government due to the high salaries? The answer there is to equalize the pay, or to at least start phasing in an equalizing of pay between the state and the NGOs. And the place to start would be with those professionals who deliver statutory work on behalf of the state. So if it's required under the Children's Act or the Older Persons Act and they're doing it as the state's agent, then they should be paid the same amount that the state is paying. So they can, you know, phase in that equal pay. And that needs to be looked at in the NPO funding policy that's been set at a national level. And that's still in finalization stages, so the committee could call in the department to question them about that. And you'll see that that NGO funding policy doesn't really distinguish between statutory services and then discretionary services, which is a problem. So the department is putting them all together and not recognizing that government doesn't actually have an obligation to fund the 76,000 NGOs out there. That's not a constitutional obligation. That's a discretion. It does, however, have a constitutional obligation to fund the NGOs who are performing statutory services. And that's where they need to look back at the law, the Children's Act and the Older Persons Act. What are those ones that government is obliged to provide? And then you're not dealing with 76,000 NGOs. You're dealing with about 20,000 max in that category, which is a doable size, you know, and it's also easier for M&E, you know, if you look at a smaller category. On the issue of gender statistics in social workers and the other types of workers, we don't have that, but I'm sure council would be able to provide it, so maybe if they could get called in, you can ask them about the breakdown. The child and youth care workers, you'll see, is a better split between men and women. So you've got a lot of young youth coming forward to train as child and youth care workers. A lot of those children that you saw there in the videos who are part of the ECBND projects actually graduate to become child and youth care workers, and they train and stay within their communities. So it does target youth, male and female. The question about do we know what's going on in the other provinces with regards to their funding of NGOs, the problem is in all 9 provinces. Unfortunately for the Free State, they're the one that got taken to court. But the same could happen in any province. Any province could be taken to court because all the policies are not paying full funding for statutory services. And the court makes it clear that if it's a constitutional statutory service that the NGO is providing, they should be paid full funding. What really needs to happen here is national needs to lead the way. So the national policy should create the standard and the norms and the funding norms, and then the provinces will follow suit. Western Cape has also published recently a new policy, also problematic, similar to the Free State problem, slightly better, but National has promised its one's going to be even better. So we're all waiting to see Nationals. On the issue around the sick mother and the number of children, in the video you see that this mother was only actually getting TB medication, so she wasn't actually getting ARVs, because this video was 4 or 5 years ago when ARVs actually weren't yet reaching many areas. But now she will qualify for ARVs, and the child and youth care worker would also assist sick parents with HIV to get ARVs, which means the mother's not going to die. And the mother will therefore be able to care for her children, and the children won't become the state's responsibility. And family planning and health promotion training should be part of the home and community-based carers and child and youth care worker training. And if it isn't, that's something you can maybe take up with them. But I'm sure basic health promotion would include that education. I'll leave the recommendations until the end because I do have them when we get to the budget slides. Thank you.
Honourable members, can we break for 5 minutes? Body break?
I'm going to go to the hospital.
combine the presentation on foster care challenges with the presentation on budget challenges. And I'm going to ask Ms. Hall and Ms. Proudlock just to step up and pace a bit. Because I'm sure that you would like to ask some questions, then we can be, you can leave at one, because I do understand the constraints that you have, because we have a sitting at 2. And you still need to go back to your offices. So, without wasting any more time, over to you, Ms. Proudlock.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and members, for letting us come and speak here. We're talking about some new research that we've done, but it's really an old issue. And this is the story of two grants for children in South Africa, which you know very well, the Child Support Grant and the Foster Care Grant. The Child Support Grant is a poverty alleviation grant. It targets the poor. The beneficiary is a primary caregiver who looks after the child, who is not necessarily the child's mother. And this is important in thinking about the purpose of the Child Support Grant and the Foster Care Grant. It also has a grant value of 260 rand a month, which will rise by 10 rand this year, which is much lower than the Foster Care Grant. This is also important. The Foster Care Grant, on the other hand, in the way it was conceptualized, was part of the child protection system as opposed to the poverty alleviation system. And they're two different things. It was designed to assist abused and neglected children who would be the responsibility of the state, and to transfer cash, some funds, to the people who were caring for them in court-ordered foster care. It requires quite a lot of work from various people in government, from social workers who have to investigate and report on the case, plus a court order from the children's court for placement into foster care. And it also requires 2 yearly extensions of the original court order, which used to involve only the social workers, and now, since the Children's Act, involves both the social workers and the courts. Obviously, this is manageable if one is dealing with small numbers of children, but as the numbers of children on foster care increase, it becomes more and more burdensome and difficult to keep up, and what we are starting to see are enormous backlogs. As I said, the grant value is much higher than the Child Support Grant. And we have seen increasingly the application of the foster care grant for orphans as an orphan grant. It's however been variously interpreted by the courts. So some courts have awarded foster care grants for the care of orphans by their relatives, and some have not. And Paula will speak just now about some of the contradictions within the Children's Act, the legal contradictions, which are causing ambiguity in understanding the purpose of the foster care grant. If we look at social grants for children, we can see a massive increase since, 1998, when the Child Support Grant was initiated. And obviously, by far the biggest grant is the Child Support Grant. You can see it in the blue area on this chart. The red area is the Foster Child Grant, which is far less than the Child Support Grant, but about 520,000 in this current month. Now, if we were to take the Child Support Grant away and just look at the growth of the Foster Care Grant, you can see that it had a sort of a fairly continuous, stable number of beneficiaries in the early years, and of course stretches back prior to the Child Support Grant. And then suddenly, from 2002, which incidentally is the year when Zola Skweyiya suggested that it should be rolled out to orphans as well, and encouraged family members to start applying for it, we started seeing an enormous increase in the number of foster care grants. In fact, in 2003, there was work done by the Children's Institute and other organizations which wanted to raise this problem. So what we're talking about here is really a historical debate, but you can see from the number of grants that it's been exacerbated over time. The 2003 work was on children in need of care or cash, and it was questioning social security provisions for orphans in the context of the South African AIDS pandemic. It pointed to an already overburdened foster care system, which was administratively burdensome, where there was insufficient social worker capacity, and where the extension of foster care to orphans risked disseminating the child protection system. And the report said, back in 2003, in the context of contemporary South Africa, it is critical that the foster care system be protected and strengthened in order to better accommodate children who do require the state to intervene in their care arrangements. This evidence was reported in various places, but it didn't shift practice, and the problem has since escalated. So many children now are in need of care and protection, and are not receiving the support that they need because of an overburdened system. Since then, we've had new developments. We've had problems with lapsing foster care grants. And this problem emerged even before the Children's Act came into effect in April last year. It's a symptom of an overburdened system that can't keep pace with the demand. So we had lapsed grants, we had the passing of the Children's Act, we've had an escalating problem with lapsed grants as well, and we've had some cases of litigation. All of this means that we've come to a point where there needs to be a clear decision made. The National Department of Social Development has started a process to review the policy on foster care grants, and the options for policy reform will need to be debated and ultimately passed by Parliament as amendments to the Children's Act and the Social Assistance Act. We cannot avoid this. So this presentation is partly about what evidence can we provide in order to assist Parliament in thinking through how to make the best decision about foster care grants. But before we get into the evidence on lapsing, Paul is going to speak a bit about foster care legal reform and recent court cases.
Okay, the foster care as an alternative care option first appeared in 1960 in the Children's Act. It was then retained in the Child Care Act in 1983. However, in 1998, the Lund Committee introduced the Child Support Grant to replace the State Maintenance Grant. Now, the State Maintenance Grant was only available to biological parents, and it was racially discriminatory in its implementation. And so the CSG introduced the concept of primary caregiver, which recognized the role that extended family was playing in the care of children in South Africa. So the CSG is available to whoever's caring for the child, granny, aunt, mother, father, whoever's the de facto carer. In 2001, the Committee of Inquiry looked into social security reform, but they didn't look at the foster care, because at the same time, the Law Commission was reviewing the Child Care Act and drafting the new Children's Act. And the Committee of Inquiry into Social Security felt that it was better placed that the issue of foster care is dealt with under the Child Care Act investigation. So the Law Commission proposed a range of placement options and grants, recognizing that foster care system could not cope with the growing number of orphans. So they recommended kinship care, informal kinship care, adoption grants, the CSG, and the FCG. So then what happened next was that the Social Assistance Act came to this committee, and again the FCG was not amended in any way, so no debate was had about the foster care grant. And finally it fell to the Children's Act to actually make the decision about this challenge. And essentially what happened is that because the Act was split into two, the first Act says one thing, and the second Act says another thing. And so when they were stuck together into the one Children's Act, they contradict each other. And this is partly as a result of the decision being separated in time. So the committees were dealing with the issue at different times, context had changed, and so the first act almost creates the interpretation that orphans already living with children already living with relatives do not qualify for the foster care grant. Whereas the second bill makes it very clear that family members do qualify to be foster parents. But the first bill contains the definition of a child in need of care and protection, which is the gateway to getting a foster care grant. That's the founding provision, it's the national act. The second bill deals with the process.
Okay, so this is why some magistrates are awarding the foster care grant to some children and others aren't. So you've got inequality happening. I'll just take you through the actual provisions compared to the Child Care Act. So, before I do that, the main point about this slide is just to point out that in none of these processes has there actually been a national debate on foster care where the issues of placement and grant have been brought together. It's always been separate. And you can't actually have this discussion or this debate without looking at it together, because it's very much about that large amount of the FCG that is driving many people to go for it. So we need to get the Directorate for Social Security to work together with the Directorate for Welfare Services on a joint policy reform process to make this decision. Otherwise, Parliament's going to end up with the Children's Bill on its table again, and you'll only be able to look at the placement, and you won't have any grant options to actually recommend to address this problem. Okay, in the Children's Act, the first step is that a social worker has to do an investigation and a report for the court. It's exactly the same in the old Child Care Act. But then comes the definition of a child in need of care and protection. Section 150 of the new Children's Act says that a child is in need of care and protection if the child has been abandoned or orphaned as and is without any visible means of support. And then an orphan is defined as a child who has no surviving parent caring for him or her. Whereas the Child Care Act had a number of grounds that could be used to place orphans in the care of relatives. There were about four grounds that you could use. You didn't have to prove that the child didn't have visible means of support. Okay, then another difference is that the duration of court orders is different. Under the new Children's Act, the norm is a two-year court order, but the court now has powers to make longer-term placements, particularly for stable placements and for family placements. So this should address some of the backlog issues because they won't have to come back every 2 years for renewal. But however, this hasn't yet kicked in, and the courts haven't yet used this section. Under the Child Care Act, there was only the two-year option. There wasn't a longer-term option. And back to the Children's Act, the last thing is the extension of court orders. Now what we require to extend them every 2 years is a social worker report and a court inquiry, which is very labor-intensive, whereas under the Child Care Act, it only required a social work investigation and a letter or a report to do that extension. But as you will see when Catherine shows you the data, the lapsing problem started before the Children's Act. So it's not only the court requirement of the extension that's causing the backlog, it's also the social workers aren't keeping up with their extensions. Now, if we look at the history of Section 150, it was actually this portfolio committee, different members but the same committee, who amended Section 150. So the table bill provided that a child is in need of care and protection if the child has been abandoned or orphaned or is without any visible means of support. So abandonment on its own would qualify the child in need of foster care. But by changing the or to an and, it requires that you have to prove orphanhood and then you also have to prove that the child doesn't have visible means of support. Now, this is a symptom of the fact that the bill was split in two. So the thinking was that the foster care should be reserved for the serious child protection cases, and that orphans living with relatives should be able to access another type of grant that didn't require social workers and courts. And there were the options of the informal kinship care grant and the kinship care grant. But when the second bill was finally tabled, those options had been taken out and were no longer on the table. The regulations don't provide any guidance on the meaning of the words visible means of support, so the magistrates are having to interpret that themselves, and that's why you're getting two different opinions. Some are interpreting it as if the child already has family care, then they have visible means of support. So if they're living with relatives, they don't need the foster care grant. Others are interpreting it as a means test. So they're actually looking at the family's income, and if the family needs the income, then they're saying yes. If they don't need the income, they're saying no, which is strange because the foster care grant is supposed to be not means tested. Okay, now the first case that has come to the court is the case of Child S,
It's a he's a boy of 10 years old who is living with his maternal great aunt and uncle. He's been living with them for 8 years, and they're now applying for the foster care grant for him. The question the court had to ask is, are orphan children like this boy who are already living in the care of their relatives without visible means of support? And in this case, the magistrate said no. This child has visible means of support, he has family care, therefore he doesn't qualify as a child in need of care and protection, so therefore he can't get the foster care grant. And this case was identified as a test case, so it doesn't only relate to this one little boy. The magistrate made the point that the foster care system, in other words, the courts and social workers, are actually operating as a maintenance income system, because the only reason for this application is that the family needs cash. The child is quite happy, the arrangement is stable. They also don't need to formalise the parental rights, because Section 32 of the Children's Act gives relatives parental rights over children in their care, so that the placement doesn't have to be legally formalised. And the magistrate is in a way playing devil's advocate here, and he's saying this, you know, Parliament and government has to make this decision, because we can't continue using the courts and social workers to simply pay out poverty grants. Why can't you use the SASA system, so the Social Assistance Agency, to pay out the grants if it's actually for poverty alleviation? Now, the importance of this case is that it's now been appealed to the High Court. If the High Court agrees with the magistrate, then this decision will bind all magistrates, and it will mean that orphans living with relatives cannot access the foster care grant. It will also mean that all those who come up for extensions are likely also to have their foster care revoked. If the magistrate's decision is overruled and the High Court says no, relatives do qualify, then the foster care grant is open for all relatives caring for orphans. The case is probably going to be heard before the end of this year. The second case is the issue of the lapsing problem. So the lapsing started already in 2009 and 10, and it's mainly due to the requirement for extensions. So the children's court order lapses. SASA is not allowed to continue to pay the grant if there's no court order, and so SASA has to stop the grant. This court order was a settlement between the Centre for Child Law, the Minister, all the MECs, and SASA, where they've all agreed to impose a moratorium on lapsing. So no more orders are allowed to lapse and no more grants are allowed to lapse, because there's no ways that the courts and the social workers are actually going to be able to keep pace, and that more and more children will keep on dropping off. And the court has said this is an interim solution, and in the meantime we can go back to the old system of social workers making the extension decision without the courts, but it's not a long-term solution. And so the Act has to be amended by 2014 to actually bring in the long-term solution. Handing back to Catherine so we can look at what's happening with the foster care grant on the ground.
Thank you. So we're going to go back and have a look at some of the numbers. And I just want to say that we've used three different sources for the numbers that we're presenting here. One is the SOCPEN data set, which we have requested extractions from SASA, so we're using their own administrative data, but we're analysing it in ways that we're not sure if they've done the same analysis. And I want to say that we had hoped to have met with them and discussed this analysis with them before we met you. It was meant to happen last week, but we ended up only meeting with the DSD, and the SASA was not able to attend. And in fact, I'm going to Pretoria tomorrow to meet with them. So we are consulting them on this analysis. The other data sources are Statistics South Africa's General Household Survey, which is a huge nationally representative survey, often used for official statistics, and then also the National Income Dynamics Study, which is also a representative national survey, which is a project of the presidency. So both of them very highly regarded data sets. So the first thing we wanted to know was, and we've been receiving monthly reports on social grants for children for a number of years now, was to have a look at what's happening with the foster care grant. And this first graph which you have, which is just a single black line, shows the number of grants, of foster care grants paid each month to children. And you can see a grey stripe coming down, which is December of each year, and you'll notice a huge drop-off,
And there's an easy explanation for that, which is that at the end of the year, when children turn 18, their grant slips, and that is legislated, it's perfectly acceptable. So we weren't concerned about those lapses. What started to concern us was, if you look at the last, particularly the last year, you see what looks like quite a lot of turbulence going on in the child support grant. So then we asked for in the foster care grant. So we then had a look at the provincial differences, and the text is quite small, but that top blue line is KwaZulu-Natal, and the next one below that, the red one, is the Eastern Cape, which together receive by far the most foster child grants. And you can see that the turbulence in the Eastern Cape was largely during 2009. The turbulence in KwaZulu-Natal was largely last year. Different things are going on in these provinces. But across all provinces, and if I can go back to the first graph, what you can see is that from 2007, where the graph starts, we see by the end of each year that we have increased quite significantly the number of foster care grants, except for the very last year, where the number has actually literally dropped off. So there's been a reversal of the pattern. The foster care grant has been growing and growing until 2010, where instead of growing, the numbers reduced by the end of the year, and they still have not managed to maintain the previous numbers. Now, this is not because people are choosing to cancel their foster care grants. Something else is going on. So we then asked for all the reason codes. Now, SASA keeps detailed codes that describe the reasons for foster grants being lapsed. And the sort of the very flat band at the bottom are a whole range of reasons which are perfectly acceptable. The beneficiary requested cancellation, the child is not in the caregiver's custody anymore, the beneficiary is deceased, although it's concerning if grants are stopped when beneficiaries are deceased. It suggests that children are vulnerable, but we are not questioning that at the moment, because what we are concerned about is which are the instances where children should actually not have been pushed off the grant system. And you can see that by far the largest reason, and we have a spike here, well, there, that is where the Children's Act was passed. So both just before and just after the Children's Act, and then continuing here with another strange lump previously in 2009, which is almost entirely in the Eastern Cape, actually. Children's foster care grants lapsing due to the court order expiring, which is also called failure to review. And the reason code failure to review was only introduced in March 2010. Before that, they didn't use it. They used court order expired, and then they introduced this new reason code just before the Children's Act came into effect, and that has now become the main reason. But we've lumped them together here because talking with the SASA officials, it seems that there's an overlap in how those codes are used. The review process is related to the court expiries. So this is hugely concerning. These are the numbers we're going to check with SASA, and it's quite possible that some of these, and we don't know how many, have been reinstated subsequently. So we're not necessarily saying all these children are still off the system, but these are grants that did lapse, and what it does is it points to a systemic underlying problem, which is that we are not keeping pace with the need for reviews. Mm. The regulations of the Social Assistance Act say that the agency must review the grant, and in the case of foster care grant, on expiry of the court order, and if the court order is not extended, the grant may be lapsed, and this is what has been happening. We also know that the lapsing predates the Children's Act. So there's a question here. There are too many foster care grant beneficiaries for the system to be able to handle in its current form, because it requires the involvement of too many people. And as we said already in the previous presentation, we don't have nearly enough social workers to do the basic welfare and protection work they're meant to be doing, let alone reviewing all foster care grants. So there's a question about who should the foster care grant be for? And the question really is, should it be made available to all orphans? So we've done a bit of analysis in the national data set, really asking, is there a rationale for orphans to receive a foster care grant on the basis of their orphan status? In other words, is the orphan status a categorical reason for a foster care grant? because when we look at the orphan numbers, we can see that that will have enormous budgetary implications and enormous implications for capacity. We're not saying that orphans are not vulnerable, but we questioning what is manageable and sustainable. So there's a kind of a question around the rationale, and there's also a question around what is feasible for us to be able to implement properly. So in what ways are orphans different from non-orphans? And we've considered, for instance, their current care arrangements, their levels of income, poverty, the willingness of relatives to provide care. There's concern that families can no longer provide further care, extended families are becoming saturated and that there will be a point at which they can't provide care anymore. There are also questions around legal duty of care and will making and appointment of guardians, which may be very relevant. So first, if we look at orphan types. Now, of course, when we say orphan, we mean different things. The vast majority of all orphans in this country are paternal orphans, which means they don't have a father. In many cases, in the majority of cases, the father is known to be deceased, but there are also cases where the father has literally disappeared. We also count these children as paternal orphans because they do not have a father. He may be dead, he may be alive, but for all intents and purposes, he is not there as a father for the child. Then a smaller proportion, 23%, are double orphans in that they have lost both their father and their mother, and another 14% have lost their mother but still have a living father. When we look at these children, we can see that very few of them are, in fact, living with their father. So we may disagree with it, but the truth is that women are primarily responsible for looking after children, and if mothers die, children are in a vulnerable position. So potentially what we're looking at, if we were to combine those two groups, maternal orphans and double orphans, we're looking at potentially 1.5 million children without mothers. Okay. If we look currently at who grants are going to, we can see, and I'm really just going to draw your attention now to the double orphans, that there's quite an even split amongst double orphans between receiving the foster care grant and receiving the child support grant. In other words, both grants are being used at present. Maternal orphans are also to some extent accessing the foster care grant. And very few non-orphans. The fact that you only see a tiny strip of red at the top of the non-orphan column means that we only have a tiny percentage of foster care grants that are going to those children who've been removed from family care for purposes of protecting them against abuse and neglect. That may be a good sign, or it may be a sign that we're missing them. So, if we think about who receives grants for orphans, and we can look at this in the National Income Dynamics Survey that I spoke about, it's largely received by relatives, and when I talk about relatives, I'm meaning grandparents, aunts or uncles, siblings, or they have a catch-all other relative, and it's mainly grandparents, it's mainly grandmothers, we know this. When we talk about orphans, we're now talking about maternal and double orphans, in other words, children whose mothers have died. And the reported grants in this national survey, which only captures the information for children under 15, is that we have nearly 300,000 orphans living with relatives getting the child support grant, and over 160,000 living with relatives getting the foster child grant. So again, we're seeing the child support grant is actually reaching more orphans. Both grants are currently being used to provide income support for relatives who are caring for orphans. And now we're at a crossroads. Which one? One of them is going to expand, the other one will contract. Which way is it going to go? And that's really the question that will be need to be answered by both the Department of Social Development and by Parliament. So here's the context. Orphaning rates have been rising significantly and will continue to rise in the future. It looks as if we may be reaching a plateau in maternal deaths by about 2015, but it will be a long time before those numbers start dropping. If we look at the care arrangements of where children are living now, we know that relatives, and especially grandmothers, provide care to large numbers of children. About 5.5 million children are cared for by their relatives. But most of these children have mothers who stay elsewhere. And most absent mothers, when we have a look at what we can see about visiting, frequency of contact, maintenance, most absent mothers have not abandoned their children.
but many of them are absent because they are looking for work somewhere else. They're often not in a position to be able to provide financial support, but it's not literally abandonment. So if we were to look at all children and where they are living, if you look at the pie, and I'm afraid that this is different to the one that you have in your pack, which was, we've used a different data source now, and we've also included all children, whereas that did not include all children, and we thought it important. So we can get this slide to you. So perhaps just look at the screen for this one. But you can see the two blue, the biggest parts, are children who are living with both parents and with only their biological mother. There may be other adults, but not their father. They only have a single biological mother living with them. So those are children who certainly would almost not ever be considered for a foster child grant unless there was a case of abuse or neglect. But you get large numbers of children who are living with relatives, and here you can see it on the pie, that more children are living with their relatives who have living mothers than are living with their relatives where their mother is deceased. And so our next question was really, what is the difference between the situations of these children? You can see that there's a very, very tiny sliver, which is children who are living with people who are not their relatives. Really a small proportion. So what you're seeing really is that relatives and extended families, and particularly grandmothers, are continuing to provide care for large numbers of children, including orphans and non-orphans. So here are the numbers, and if we wanted to compare these groups, and what we've done is we've looked at the average, the median income per person in these households, you can see that firstly, all income is very low. It's way below the sort of official poverty line, which says you can live and develop healthily. It's about on a par with, even if you're living with both parents, it's about on a par with the lower poverty line, which says this is only just enough money you need to survive. Children who are double orphans, who are living with their relatives, have far less income than that, 370 rand a month per person, which is extremely low. And similarly, if their mother's deceased, it's a similar level of poverty. But when we looked at children who are living with relatives who have a living mother, they're also similarly poor or even poorer. And in fact, the poorest category seem to be children who are only living with their mother. So it seems on this argument there's not potentially a financial basis to provide the children in foster care, if they were orphans, would need more money. So again, it's about separating what are the care needs, what are the financial needs, and what are the protection needs, and they seem to be different issues. So in summary then, relatives care for millions of children. Orphans are poorer than non-orphans if we look at the categories as a whole, but if we break them down further, children with non-resident living mothers are equally poor and greater in number. So in numeric terms, they constitute a greater burden of care for grandmothers and other relatives. And children with only one co-resident parent, the mother, are the poorest category. What then are the options? And it seems very complicated, and we don't have clear recommendations, but we've tried to define some questions. Firstly, are the orphans living with poor relatives in need of care and protection from the state, or are they in need of cash transfers for poverty alleviation, or both? So the question really is the foster care grant a child protection or a poverty alleviation grant? If the foster care grant is for child protection, then how do we reduce numbers? Because we will have to, in order to provide the support that is needed to ensure that the child is protected. It's already beyond capacity. It's clogging the courts. It's diverting social workers from their main function, which is child protection. If families are in need of cash grants for poverty alleviation, why not use the administratively simpler child support grant rather than the foster care grant if it's about financial support? That's what the child support was designed for. The application process is very quick, cheap for the state to implement, not burdensome for the applicants. It's designed to get people, poor people, onto the system fast and to keep them there. So the main appeal, as the judge said, of the foster child grant is its high value compared with the child support grant in the context of poverty and unemployment, which really is the underlying challenge to much of this. In that context, what is the rationale for the state's current policy of providing more cash to relatives caring for orphans as opposed to relatives or parents caring for non-orphans. Is that policy fair and reasonable? Does it discriminate against poor parents? What are the possible grant options? We could think beyond just these two grants. And with what administrative requirements and what grant values? So one could think about a CSG, or one could think about a CSG with an increased value, something more similar to the foster care grant that starts to equalize those two, so that that financial support, that the amount of the grant is not the main attraction of the foster child grant, that it is about protection. One could think about extending the foster child grant to all orphans, but as we've seen, the numbers are enormous already and are likely to grow. One could think about a kinship grant or an adoption grant or the other options originally proposed by the Law Reform Commission. These are a whole lot of options, but what we do know is that the Children's Act and the Social Assistance Act will be amended to provide for a more comprehensive legal solution. And what should the solution be? Thank you.
Honourable members, can you believe we're able to do this in 10 minutes? We'll be out of here by 10 past one. The Honourable Chairperson of the Committee on Women and Children, People with Disabilities, will be leaving us. Thanks. I think what we can do, because the Institute is based in Cape Town, we can, with the indulgence we can, and your indulgence on your members, we can then also reschedule another meeting. So that we can have a good discussion and interrogate them more intensely. Can we say that we'll see how far we get by 10 plus 1, and then we will reconvene when we get back? But this really lays a foundation for a very good oversight program that we've had. Over to you.
Okay, I'm going to try and whip through this. This is based on research by CASE and the Children's Institute. And the questions we're answering here, the first is, how much did the 9 provincial departments allocate for implementing the Children's Act in the 2010-11 financial year? We've used 2010 and 11 because we haven't yet finished the 11-12 analysis. And we also wanted to compare it to the research we finished last year on how much the donors are contributing so that we could show the whole combined picture. We then also compare that to how much the cost in report said should have been allocated, and then we can see the gap in allocation. And then we've got some recommendations on how the gap between what is needed and what's being allocated can be addressed. So the first question, how much are the provinces allocating? The provinces are responsible for more than 83% of the services in the Children's Act. So whereas other departments like Education, Justice and SAPS are also responsible for their part in the Children's Act, the main burden falls on the provincial departments of social development. So if we look at their budgets, we can get a good sense of whether government is allocating sufficient money and actually implementing the Children's Act. The provinces get their money via the Division of Revenue Act, which allocates the national revenue between the three spheres and between the 9 provinces. And the Division of Revenue Act uses the equitable share formula to decide how much goes to national, to province, to local, and then how much goes to each province. And you'll see that there's problems in the equitable share formula. The main problem is that they have not amended this formula to actually take account of all the legislation that this committee has passed. So this committee has passed the Older Persons Act, the Prevention of Substance Abuse Act, and the Children's Act, which have all increased the burden on provinces to deliver services. But the equitable share formula hasn't changed to actually recognize that provinces now bear an increased responsibility and should get a larger piece of the national pie. Okay, I've already gone through this point as to how the provinces fund these services. They deliver them themselves or they fund the NGOs. Now this table shows you how much each province allocated in 2010-11. You can see the larger provinces with more children have larger amounts. Gauteng shouldn't have a larger amount than KwaZulu-Natal.
but it does. So that again shows you there's inequality between the provinces in terms of how much they're allocating. And that's also very much because provinces have discretion. When they receive that lump sum from National Treasury, they have discretion as to how much they give to each department. The total, however, across the country is $3.4 billion. We have analyzed the total for 2011-12, has gone to up to $3.8 billion. The way we make this calculation is that we look at the provincial budget sub-programs, and within the provincial budgets, you get the social welfare services program, and then they have a lot of sub-programs underneath that. The four that are shaded, the child care and protection, HIV and AIDS, care and support to families, and crime prevention and support, is where you'll find most of the money for the Children's Act implementation. Child care and protection is the biggest one. It's definitely got the lion's share. The child care and protection actually makes up 37% of the whole social welfare budget at a provincial level. The others come quite far behind at 10%, 9% and 3% for crime prevention, HIV AIDS and family care and support. So the main one to actually watch is the child care and protection sub-program. And a concern here is that three of the provinces, North, West, Western Cape and Eastern Cape, have a three-year average annual increase that is below or only slightly above inflation for the child care and protection program. So there's no ways that services can actually grow in those provinces if they're not even meeting the inflation increase. So across the provinces, the average annual growth is 13% per year, but if we subtract inflation, which is 6%, the average annual growth per year is 7% for the sub-program. It's good growth in a recession. Many of the other departments didn't see this kind of growth, but it's not good enough growth for a new act that needs to scale up fast to reach all children in need. And again, those three provinces in red are flagged as needing attention, as they actually are below inflation. If we look at the care and support to family sub-program, which is where the child and family counselling would fall, this one has an increase that's below inflation, so it only had a 5% increase, so it's not growing. And they've got flagged four provinces who need attention there: Free State, Western Cape, Gauteng, and Limpopo. This program, HIV/AIDS, is where your home and community-based care programs will be. This one had a growth of 7%, which is 1% above inflation, so there is growth, but it's not much. And then some very worrying trends in some of the provinces. So Western Cape, last year, a dip of 25% in its HIV/AIDS program. So you need to ask, where did that money go? And the money actually went into modernization of the department, which involved more offices and computers. Then the next question is, we look at, okay, there's obviously not enough money, and the budgets aren't growing. You know, can we get some more money from the donors? And so we looked at how much the donors were funding. And these are the categories we looked at. So the official development assistance from foreign governments, international NGOs like Save the Children and Oxfam, international foundations like ALMA and Bill and Melinda Gates, private national business donors, Mondi, Coca-Cola, Mr. Price, and then there's also national foundations like the DG Murray Trust, and then the government-related donors. So we looked at that pot. We did a survey with those donors and with the NGOs to find out how much are the donors giving. And we found out that the donors are contributing approximately $1 billion, which is one quarter of what government is contributing, and the main donors are their foreign governments. Then we look at how much does the Children's Act costing say should have been allocated. And the Children's Act costing is the most objective analysis of that we can use to assess it. We've updated the costing for inflation because it was done in 2005. This table, which is also in a publication that's in your pack, explains the implementation plan versus the full cost. Because the costing was done on four different scenarios. There were two scenarios under implementation plan, which are based on simply scaling up the 2,000 levels of service delivery in a phased manner. The full cost plan was based on actual numbers of children who needed the services. We should be using the full cost plan as our target to chase. So either the $30 billion or the $60 billion. But the reality is that we're not even meeting the lowest standard, which is the 7.5 billion. So the gap in allocation is that for the lowest standard of 7.5 billion, we only allocated 3.4. Therefore, our shortfall last year was 4 billion. If we actually look at the full cost scenarios, our shortfall was 55 billion. This graph shows you that great variation across the provinces in meeting the IP low costing estimate of 7.5 billion. So across all the provinces, we are meeting 45% of the implementation plan lowest scenario, which is the lowest level. Great variation across the provinces, some much lower than others, so Limpopo, Eastern Cape, particularly worrying. Here's another way of looking at it. The bottom slice, the grey one, is the 3.4 billion that the provinces are contributing. We add then 800 million from the foreign governments, and we have a total of 4.2 billion. We're still very far away from the 7.5 billion. And nowhere near the one, the 10.8, the 30, or the 59. So it's quite a graphical representation of a very low budget. And why this budget is very different to the budgets for health and education is that this area didn't have a new law until only last year, whereas health and education had completely new policies and frameworks in the late 1990s, early 2000s. So the budget was able to grow for health and education. So if you compare the 3.4 to our health and education budgets, which are over 100 billion per year, you'll see that this little area has been very, very badly neglected over the years, so it has to catch up. Okay, some suggestions on how to address the gap is we need to look at other sources of funding that we can pull on besides these donors and the provincial departments. Particularly for this committee, the NCOP and the provincial legislatures, to look at is where are the decisions about the provincial budgets being made and how can we influence those decisions? And how can we actually step up the pace of service delivery? The donor research showed that the donor money is actually going to decrease. The main reason is that some of the bilaterals and the international donors are scaling down their funding in South Africa because South Africa is being classified as a middle-income country and there are other countries with greater need. So that's a problem, particularly if the larger bilaterals pull out. So we need to think about how can we persuade the donors to stay and increase their funding, and also how can we attract other donors. So some of the other foreign governments are not funding childcare protection services. They're funding, say, trade and industry or education or health. So how can we attract some money from them to this sector as well? In the NDA and the lottery, particularly the NDA is something this committee could engage with. We found that the NDA is not one of the top funders for Children's Act services. And so we need to look at the priority setting followed by the NDA, you know, and who it's funding and why. Then the President's Job Fund, as I've mentioned, that fund is located in the Treasury vote. It's not in DSD. And at the moment, departments and organizations are bidding for that money. And if the BND proposal by the minister can be supported and get that money, then we're tapping into the President's Job Fund as well, and the budget will increase. Then to look at the how can Parliament influence the budget decision making. We had a conference at National Treasury 2 weeks ago where we had the donors, Treasury, and the departments and NGOs together. And everyone agreed that the main problem is that childcare and protection services are not a national priority. So you'll see that education and health are flagged as national government priorities. But childcare and protection services do not come up in government strategic plan. They're also not flagged in the National Planning Commission's report, and therefore won't get picked up in the National Planning Commission's plan for the next 25 years. You also won't find them featuring high on political party conferences and manifestos. It's often framed as crime prevention, but this broader category of services under the Children's Act, which is child care and protection services, doesn't get flagged as a priority. And the Treasury representative for social development continues to say that he can't fight for more budget for social development until its childcare and protection is made a national priority. So that's the first block. The second is that we need to increase the province's share of national revenue. So more money needs to go to provinces and less to national. And this is, again, this is the equitable share formula, and this is firmly within Parliament's ambit, this Parliament's ambit, because you passed the Division of Revenue Bill and you engage with that split. Okay. Then we need to increase the Department of Social Development share at each provincial budget. And this is a decision that's made by the provincial treasuries and the provincial legislatures. Provincial treasury, provincial legislatures don't yet have power to actually amend their budget, so it's actually the provincial treasury that has to be the target. And there the MECs for social development and the HODs have to be strengthened to lobby their case at a provincial treasury level. Then when the provincial department gets its budget from provincial treasury, it then splits it between substance abuse, child care and protection, victim support. And we also want to see the child care and protection section there growing as well. And that is something that lies with the provincial MECs. Then also if we increase the share of the department's budget that is allocated to NPOs, we will also see faster service expansion, because the NGOs are more flexible and do roll out the services faster than the government systems. So that's some clear, you know, oversight areas around the budget. With service delivery, if we can finalize that national policy for financing of NPOs, that is really going to boost service delivery and increase the budget. So that's, and that is something that the department is going to do, finish this year. So it would need to come to Parliament this year. And if we had proper contracting between the services between DSD and NPOs, at the moment the funding is done on a charity model, but if government employs someone to build a road, they have a corporate contract between themselves and the road builder. So we need the same for NGOs running children's homes or statutory services. There must be a proper contract between government and the NGO. And this will also ensure that government can direct and monitor the services that the NGOs are providing. It will ensure the NPOs are fully covered, and it will also enable them to expand to reach the under-reached areas. It will also prevent the closure of NPOs and the loss of jobs. There's a lot of NPOs who have already closed and on the brink of closure at the moment, due to the donor funding having dried up and the government funding not increasing. Other ways to step up service delivery is to promote the multidisciplinary team approach. So to recognize and support all the categories of workers. So when the department comes and presents its HR strategy, to make sure that it includes all the categories, social workers, child and youth care workers, ECD, so to look at the whole army, because we will never have enough social workers, so we have to task shift to the other workers. And then invest in the social franchise models and take them to scale. It was a question before about, you know, is this being the only one? No, it's not. There are many other social franchise models. For instance, Atiba Vikeli, which is a model run by Child Welfare, Gulama, which is run by Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, similar to Isibindi, and in fact, they're all going to get together for this Isibindi roller and do it together. So there might be a merging of the models. But the idea is to take as many of those up to scale, because they have management systems, M&E systems, and quality management. This last slide, which is probably not in your pack, I have to provide it, just gives you a list. Okay. Well, that's just a list of areas that the committee could look at to unlock some of these blockages.
Well, thanks, Mrs. Douglas and Ms. Walker, for really doing a good job in the limited time. I could see in those faces they were really into the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
It really gives us a very clear view of what to look for when we go on oversight to the Eastern Cape. But also in terms of the challenges facing our institutions. Honourable members, can I give you 5 minutes for questions? Honourable Member Duncan, Honourable Member Kenya, Honourable Member Foley, very quiet. Any other member that I should note? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm very happy now. We have questions and we have recommendations. Thank you very much for that. I just have one question. To ask the Institute, do we perhaps have a database or information on what is the demand for adopting children in South Africa? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also have one question. Thank you for the presentation. My question is on the issue of NPO funding trends. It is said that the NPOs are the ones who are working very hard in the delivery indicators so that NPOs deliver services to more people than government commercial organizations, but NPOs struggle to find sufficient funding. Now, on the main approaches used by the government to fund NPOs, also I have a problem that on program funding, it's only the pilot programs are being funded. And that's what I want to question. My question is that, is there any monitoring strategies to avoid the collapse of those pilot programs? I hope also, and the issue of the funding trends, how are we going to see that? And we said that operators rely heavily on the services of non-profit organizations to deliver services. As we said that in the previous presentation, that they are the ones that provide services more than the government. Now I'm worried about that, the funding pattern of them, of the pilots, of the NPOs. Thank you.
Okay. Any other members? Because it's just this one round.
Thank you, Chef. I just wanted to find out, according to the presentation, it is clearly saying that the provinces are not budgeting enough for social welfare services. Does it mean it's because of the lack of shortage of social welfare practitioners? And what are the implications in terms of children's rights?
Okay. I think that takes care of the questions, honourable members. can I give over to Ms. Hall and Ms. Proudlock to respond to that?
Okay, on the issue of adoption, I think you'll need to ask the department, national department, that question. They actually did a big research study and have adopted an adoption strategy to promote adoption. And the research study will give you indications of demand. I think it's more what they definitely do have is a database on adoptable children. So that's been built up. It's a requirement under the Children's Act, but it's in progress. So you'll be able to know how many children are up for adoption, but whether there's a demand from people to adopt is a debatable issue. And this is also where the foster care grant comes in, is that there's no incentive to adopt. Once you adopt, your foster care grant is stopped, you see. So most families don't want to go the adoption route because they're going to lose the income grant, which is why the Law Commission also recommended an adoption grant so that you wouldn't disincentivize adoption. There's also issues around adoption where it actually changes the child's name and the child's relationship to the caregiver, whereas previously the caregiver was the granny. Adoption can create a situation where the granny is seen as the parent, and sometimes this is seen as culturally unacceptable. So there are a number of reasons why adoption, isn't the preferred option, but I would suggest you get the department to come and present on that. Then the question on program funding, just to correct, it's not only the pilots that are funded for program funding. It's a way that pilots tend to be funded. There are other services, like, for instance, child and family counselling, that's funded on a program basis. Some of the new ECD outreach programs are also funded on a program basis. And many of the social franchise models that are now big work pilots, and they started off with donor funding, and they grew with donor funding, but the good news is that they're now half donor and half government. So government has come in. So if these donors do start pulling out, government is able to actually take over many of those projects so that you don't lose the investment that you put in the staff and the training and the infrastructure and the building up of those projects. As to why the provinces are not budgeting enough, they're often not able to show that they have the capacity to spend and deliver the services, and that's partly because there's not enough human resources, but it's also because they're not including the NGO business plans in their bids. So what happens is they ask for their money first, and then the NGO has to come and apply for the money. Whereas if the, like they're going to do now for this big Isibindi bid, if they were to get together with the NGOs and do joint budget planning, they can actually use the NGO data to show treasuries that they have the capacity to deliver because the NGOs have the workers and the systems. If you even bring in the donors into that planning as well, you'll show even greater capacity to take the projects to scale. So I think joint budget planning between NGOs and the provinces before they actually submit their proposals to Treasury.
Funding to NGOs, there is a special criteria. Does that criteria affect funding for NGOs too? Is that from provincial government?
I'm going to use ECD as an example. An ECD centre cannot qualify for government funding unless it has NPO registration, which requires a whole lot of financial reporting requirements, which they can't often meet. If they do manage to get NPO registration, they can't qualify for ECD subsidies unless they meet the norms and standards required by the Children's Act, which are too high for most ECD centres because they don't have sufficient budget to pay for the care workers or the toilets or the food that's required for the children. There is a mechanism called conditional registration provided in the Children's Act for all the services where they can get conditionally registered and given time to meet the norms and standards. But the department would then need to ensure they fund them sufficiently so they can meet the norms and standards. So, you know, there's many, many reasons. There are very good criteria set, but the majority of NGOs can't actually meet them because they don't have sufficient funding.
I think the one issue I want to caution members generally in terms of not seeing NGOs as being junior government departments. Just looking at the role of NGOs and the role that they play in society. The other issue I want to raise with members is the issue of the safety and the rights of children. If you look at the, let's take the registration of an ECD centre. If government registers an ECD centre that doesn't have the right facilities, that doesn't have, that are dangerous, that doesn't have a developmental program, government needs to first, you can't register a centre like that because it will endanger the life of children and their health. And ECD centres are not just there for a play centre. Children can't play the whole day. So you need to make sure that there are certain norms and standards. So in terms of government's responsibility is to see, that's why I think the EPWP program is such a good program, because that's where you can get your existing childcare facilities, having those workers get a qualified qualification while working at the ECD centre at the same time, and then also your cooks at the ECD centre. I think for them, the cooks get the NQF level 2 qualification, and that is I think sponsored through the health and welfare CETA. So if we have those programs and you are, and government is consistent with that, you will then make an impact in terms of registering more ECD sites, but making sure that they do qualify in terms of your norms and standards
by having these incentive programs. So that's why you're monitoring a new evaluation. I think Paula referred to that. And I think it was Catherine. It's very important. If you don't have monitoring and evaluation, you can forget about NGOs having delivering a quality service. Also in terms of really implementing and monitoring your service level agreements. And in some cases, there is no really qualitative service level agreement. And then you can't measure the impact that that program is having in certain communities. And that is very important. What I want to say to Honourable Member Duncan, last year we had a presentation on adoption in the committee made by the minister and I think it was the doctor that was, I can't remember the official's name. They made a presentation on adoption, and I think we can get that presentation from the committee secretary. It was extremely informative. But I think in the budget speech, the minister also made some more commitments in terms of adoption. So I think we need to follow up on the adoption issue. And maybe the two committees can do that together. I think that's very important. Because we also got just a bird's eye view in terms of your international social services that the department is also rendering to mothers that have children, mothers that are in prison, and these other issues that they would have. We also got a blink, just a bird's eye view of that kind. That's those services, because we tend to focus on your victim empowerment services and your other services and forget about the other crucial services that are there. What is it all about?
I don't know if you know what you say, the rest of kids, but you know, it's always worrying me that the child support grant is growing, and it is growing severely. Why can't we do something about fathers fathering children, putting that burden completely onto the state? In so many cases, they just disappear. I can't believe it when I walk into the centres, seeing that this side of the hall is only for child support. And then I wondered if all those fathers have gone, what happened to those fathers? They fathered children. Why are we taking the liability of those fathers? I know we need to urgently care for the well-being of that child. But what is happening to the responsibility of that father, father and the child? Did you ever do any research on that?
One thing that we do know is that when they do the means test for the child support grant, they take into account the income of the child's caregiver, which in many instances is the mother, and their spouse, whether or not they live in the household. So they're meant to be looking at father's income too. And we know that income levels are incredibly low. I mean, my opinion is that the underlying issue is massive unemployment. And yes, there's been concern about the nature of the family and the role of parents and the role of fathers in children's lives. And I think that it's a very complex issue, and there are a whole range of historical and labor migration related and cultural issues attached to those which perhaps need to be explored. But in terms of income maintenance, we know that the maintenance system is not particularly good. We know also that there has been a declining remittances to households. So households are getting less remittances from absent members than they used to be. And yes, this may be linked to grants. So it may be that more grants, for instance, are going to rural areas, and those households are receiving less remittances from family members living elsewhere. Is that a bad thing? If
if what that means is that people who migrate to cities, for instance, to find work, are able to invest the money that they spend in, for instance, establishing housing and accommodation to enable to bring families to live with them. We've known that for years people who work in cities have to send enormous amounts of their money back home. So how do people start breaking out of the existing spatial patterns of poverty where households are split, families are split, old women look after young children in rural areas in order to free up people to go and find work? How does one get out of that? How to enable households to start coming out of poverty? I think that there's a lot of concern about the size of the budget for social grants, but in fact it's a tiny proportion of our GDP. And as a taxpayer, I'm quite happy that a lot of my tax goes to redistributing money across the country. So I think that there's a sort of a philosophical argument.
Thank you very much, honourable members. I think that's a debate where we also should look at parenting skills for young parents. That is something that we are still lacking, that we need to look at. Honourable members, let me take this opportunity to thank Paula Proudlock and Catherine Hall and team from the Children's Institute from the city for, I think it was a fantastic day for us. Can we give them a hand? I'm saddened that we don't have more time the rest of the day, but we have the president's budget debate, budget vote today. But can we say, take this decision as the committee, and then we would like to invite the committee, our sister committee again, in terms of having a follow-up meeting with the Children's Institute. Can we give members some time just to look at these presentations more in detail? We come back from oversight, and then we invite the Children's Institute, and we can then beforehand just structure the approach we're going to have when we invite them at one of our meetings when we come back, so that we can just have some more structural engagements. Does that sound fine, members? Thank you.
If we can also look at inviting the NGOs.
Yeah.
I said that earlier this year that we will be inviting them, and I'm worried that we're not inviting them, and they are still faced with so many challenges.
Yeah.
You know?
Honourable Member Lambola, you must remember our plate's full. So I was thinking of inviting the governing bodies, the bodies that represent the NGOs, because we already had bodies like SANCA and so on to the committee. You look at Mboko, and I don't know who's the other bodies that represent in NPOs in the country, and have a Idaba day with him. Okay, thank you very much, honourable members. I hope you still have about 5 minutes for lunch.